Whatto, friends, it's Jason here, Dr. Jason Fox, Fox Wizard. You're listening to Fox Wizard Questing Betwixt, Living and Leading in a Time Betwixt Worlds. I have a meeting in 40 minutes, so this episode shan't go for too much longer than that. And in theory, I shall be chatting with you about a hermetic disposition. It's an essay that I'm writing currently for a newsletter, about 70% of the way through. And it has been such a reminder to me of the disposition that I love to embody, that I find quite enlivening and just efficacious too. And I want to share some of that with you as well. But as ever, we might not get there. I've been listening to some Blind Boy podcasts recently, and I just love, I seem to be not rare, but certainly a minority of folks, you're one of them too, kindred spirits, who love listening to conversations that feel like an audio note between friends. At the same time, I'm also empathetic to the fact that we are in a distraction economy. Attention is sacred. And I do not take for granted anyone who devotes their attention to my ramblings in this podcast. So it's a fine tightrope to kind of tread here. How much do we indulge in the pure kind of non-linear, emergent, serendipitous, circumambulatory? To amble means to walk about things slowly, and there's a perambulatory, that's what I'm thinking, is where you kind of walk along the perimeter, perambly. Yeah. Anyway, I'm just glad you're here with me. So, it's been a while since I've done the personal reflection. The last time I did this was in a very astrologically powerful month of September, betwixt two eclipses. And I was sitting on the river. It was near the spring equinox, and we had the birds chirping away, and the sun was fading. It was all quite cosmic and wonderful. And I made this quite resolve to do a podcast for you monthly, a monthly newsletter, a monthly podcast, very much inspired by Time and Other Thieves by Sarah B. and Kenning's Botanical Studies of Internet Magic or something like that. Effectively, folks in the small, quiet, poetic web that quietly tend to their things and do their things in their own way. And I haven't been subsumed by the game theoretical optimization of the centralized algorithms that dictate a lot of how people show up and what we do. But I haven't done monthly things since then. We have done three episodes of Kindred Spirits, episodes 7, 8, 9, and 10. That's four episodes. Four episodes of Kindred Spirits in that time. There's something I find quite... it's nice being in dialogue. And these solo podcasts do feel a little bit solipsistic and indulgent. And I'm always baffled to hear that folks actually listen to them. But I've actually heard from many folks that do. Had a wonderful conversation with a new friend in the Netherlands who has been subscribed for many years. We just spoke, and that is nice. Good on you for listening. I've also written a post. I'm just going through the posts that I've written since the equinox one. A post on hiding in plain sight, in which you might recall the equinox podcast that I did. If you listen to it, I was talking about my book, Mythic Mode, which I've been writing on and off for about, feels like 8 years now. I've been rather coy about it because I've just seen so many times. Once the mainstream get hold of a particular idea, once capitalism sinks its claws into it, it just becomes distorted and corrupted and bent out of shape, and it loses a lot of the vitality, the animate force, the life essence that actually gives it its magic in the first place. And so I saw this when people were beginning to draw the connections between the kind of the wonder of games, of when people play games, of just how enthralled and motivated and focused and immersed they are. And I saw that turn into gamification, which was... you know, had some merit, and I was there and I wrote a book called The Game Changer, but I just saw how far it drifted. And I see this with most things. I saw Simon Sinek do it with James Castle's book, Finite and Infinite Games. And look, this is not bad. It just is. This is just what happens. We're in a paradigm of of a world where ideas are kind of extracted from the periphery and then fed to the masses in the center. And the process of that requires some level of extraction and reduction so that it can be hammered into a form that appeals to the total addressable market, and the largest of which occupies the I guess, the peak of the midwit curve. And I'm trying to actually, no, I delete all that. I'm trying to show up a lot more kinder these days. I realize just how inadvertently I perpetuate the same rivalrous dynamics I talk in response to. Even when it comes to my reference of the machine, I feel like there's a danger in that. If you speak about it, you give it more power. And so we need to slip this. This is part of the hermetic disposition that I'm going to be telling you of. Anywho, so I wrote Hiding in Plain Sight, in which I talked about mythic mode and the fact that David Chapman, the wonderful mind behind meta-rationality, meaningness, vividness, and a lot... I mean, David Chapman's work has been hugely influential in my world, particularly when I started to realize that the rational mode itself was limited. And I thought that I had gone through the nihilistic gap that happens when you realize that all the foundations of your knowledge, the ontology that you have is actually not solid foundations. They're based on a kind of nebulous, interrelated, intercontingent patterns that don't have form themselves and yet a pattern, the nebulous yet pattern. But this is quite disconcerting because for many, it means the foundations of their very orientation for reality, for living and being, isn't as solid as you'd think. I thought that I'd gone through the nihilistic gap, but recent times revealed to me that I also still had a lot of naive hope placed in, I don't know, concepts like international law, my background in environmental sciences and lecturing at a few universities, in that, you know, I learnt and taught in a time where academics had, were feeling pretty good because the world had slowly but inevitably rallied to work together to eliminate chlorofluorocarbons from fridges and cooling devices, which effectively meant that the ozone emissions, the ozone layer wasn't attacked as much, which meant the hole in the ozone layer wasn't getting bigger. And it felt like a great time of global cooperation. And so a lot of scientists thought, well, we just need to kind of point out the facts about climate change and global warming, and then surely we'll rally together again. Alas, though, this is a hyper object. It's so complex and entwined with incentives, with money, with markets, with power. And the future is not going to be changed with more fact. And unfortunately, with recent times with international law, particularly international human rights law, I think we've all witnessed that it's largely determined by those in power. And so the meta-crisis realization took me back into the nihilistic gap a little bit. Happy to say now I'm out of the dark forest. I'm mostly embodying a post-tragic disposition. This also includes, I'd suggest, a post-activist disposition. In that, and this comes back to the hermetic thing that I'm going to be telling you of soon, in that you realize that a lot of your attempts at overt activism are useful and needed and necessary, and sometimes can simply perpetuate the very paradigm we're in. And I feel that the role that I play, there's a little bit more power in the kind of the trickster mode, which requires a bit more attention to the slip, the kind of transposing polarities. And we'll talk about that soon. I also talked about horizontal wizardry. I've made a post on that, lifting James Carse's notion of horizontal ways of seeing rather than bounded ways of seeing. This came to light when I was working with a very large bank on their with their team that were looking at their strategy. a strategy that needs to make sense in the cybersecurity context, which is constantly changing, dynamic, complex, emergent. You can't rest upon your laurels. You can't simply set and forget some sort of fix. It is a complex domain, not complicated. And yet this particular team had to submit annual strategies in advance in order to get budget to fund certain things. So there's a mismatch within the philosophy that was applied to how strategy was done. They're taking a bounded approach to strategy for what should be a horizontal way of engaging with an evergreen challenge of protecting users, clients' funds, and maintaining cybersecurity. So that inspired that post. In that post, I also teased the notion of the School of Fox Wizardry, something I've been plotting on for years, but particularly in the last few months. Right now, I'm feeling tired. I feel like the world is largely tired. There is so much of a torrent of things going online. Originally, I was going to be promoting this over December and January to start in February. We might start in March. The School of Fox Wizardry is largely for folks that I would consider to be liminal leaders. So a liminal leader, leader, I don't even like the term leader, but it serves. Liminal leaders are folks who recognize that the old paradigm is inadequate for the problems of today. Even if we maintain and improve it, which we still need to do, it's still going to be inadequate for the challenges we face today. And yet the new paradigm has yet to cohere, and the pathway forward remains non-obvious. And there are many that will choose to simply wait within the context of the old paradigm that generates and perpetuates the challenges that it can't solve. And then there are some of us that step into the liminal, this time betwixt worlds, to sense into and cohere and find new ways. And this, of course, is approached in a sense of a protosynthesis, a prototype synthesis, where we're constantly imbibing and updating our dispositional ontology based upon new information as it comes to light. But it's a participatory knowingness that has some of us enact the emergent roles that we need to play so that we can be of service in this time betwixt worlds. Obviously, I have a bias towards world more curious and kind. But we all have our part to play in this. It's been interesting looking at a character like Venkatesh Rao, a thinker who I've been following for many years and admire. He's decided in a recent post titled Be Slightly Monstrous, which is a play on his old post, Be Slightly Evil, Be Slightly Monstrous, where he's full-on embracing AI slop, AI disposition, AI a lot of things, and trying to think like a monster, think like the machine, just slightly. But the stance we need to have here is of integrative pluralism. There is no one way, so we need to be able to accept there's going to be a diversity, a pluralism, plurality of ways. And how can we work in manners that integrates and coheres together so that we can collectively co-coordinate towards a world more curious and kind, or at least whatever is in store for this emergent, unfolding, unfurling shared experience of life that we share. So the School of Fox Wizardry trains folks for that. It involves some subversive fox magics that can't really work in the context of teaching this within enterprise land. It requires that meta-rational savvy and a kind of strategic cunning that behooves you to be construct aware. So this appeals to executives that come in and can see the systems and can take a meta-systemic approach and know the levers to tweak so as to bring about and effect great change. It'll appeal to academics that are perhaps feeling some of the constraints of the context that they're in, and they're wanting to be both more commercially effective and have greater impact beyond the papers that are published and the lectures that are taught. It'll appeal to independent consultants that enjoy this kind of work and they're enlivened by the evergreen curiosity and constantly changing dynamics of the field in which we work within. And then they'll also, I think the school will also appeal to the folks that are actually doing the work out beyond the liminal, the poets, the shamans, the artists, the bards, the folks that have long been doing this. And these are the folks that often the consultants and executives will be using their ideas in 5 years' time and probably getting the funds and credit for. And I know a lot of these folks are wonderful folks that could probably do with earning a bit more coin. I've been fairly lucky in my career in that I've been able to do this for, probably about 16, 17 years now. And for the majority of that, I haven't had to sell out too much. And I've been able to maintain independence of thinking and thought and bring fresh and post-conventional ways of seeing into the mix and the work that I do with my clients. And I'm lucky that the clients that I have are liminal leaders themselves. Anywho, I'm putting together the school. I think it will appeal. You will hear me speak more of this specifically in future episodes. I just want to make one note, though. Frank Shimero, he's I think a New York-based author, wrote this incredible piece called Selling Lemons. I've mentioned it a few times in my recent musings. The idea that a lot of markets, particularly where there's knowledge asymmetry, become lemon markets. And this is a saying based upon used cars, where it's really hard to differentiate between what is a good used car of quality and what is actually a lemon. Obviously, there's more upside to selling a shitty car for a price that is like of a good used car. Whereas if you have a good used car, it's hard to differentiate in terms of price because the buyer doesn't know the difference between a lemon car, a shitty car, and a good used car. So the dynamics of that drive everything to the bottom. Frank makes great examples regarding like how online dating has become like this, where it's easy for assholes to pretend to be nice guys, and how can you tell anyway? So the apps end up getting flooded by assholes, and then, you know, folks don't want to use it because they have terrible dating experiences, and so they leave. I feel like this is also the case when it comes to thought leadership. It is, as I say, the most horrible yet correct advice. It is better to be a better marketer of what you do than it is to be a better doer of what you do. This is unfortunately true. I don't like it. I focused on being a better doer of what I do. And this is not good advice for most people because the good advice is to focus on marketing yourself, except I believe that paradigm is collapsing. We're in this new zone here where the rules that have worked beforehand aren't necessarily going to work anymore. There are counter currents that are happening. There is a counter trend against AI. There's a counter trend against social media itself. And in amongst this, you know, the thesis that Frank Shimero shares is that with lemon markets, the good quality folks leave the markets because they just can't be bothered with the bullshit anymore. Where do they go, though? That is the thing. Now, my understanding of this is that there is an underweb of warm referrals, a kind of networked thing where if you know, you know. And this is the same when it comes to plant medicines. There are a lot of charlatans out there that are, you know, rubbish. But when you have not just warm leads, but hot leads, trusted, you know, personally recommended, endorsed connections, there is an undercurrent. So you can find quality. I think this is also the same with independent consulting with thought leadership too. When you can display a body of work, when you can show consistency and depth in your thinking, when you can show up across multiple contexts and not just be parroting the charismatic shtick, but actually demonstrating a capacity for complexity, for depth, and a willingness to learn and to respond and to work without ego for genuine value and relevance realization, it carries. And so my sense was, first of all, to run the school of Fox Wizardry to teach some of these things. But ultimately, in 2 to 5 years' time, I'd like to think that we have a bit of a guild going on, a kind of, you know, many chapters around the world, I'll start here in Melbourne, but we'll have other folks trained up, and it'll be like various thieves guilds, except not obviously not stealing things, except maybe in a Terry Pratchett sense of like coordinated, you know, we'll obtain coin in exchange for value. But a genuine network of wizards, of spellcasters, of independent consultants, of mythic folk who very good at what they do, have a demonstrated body of work, and we have the warm relationality amidst us, so that I think there's an alternative to the consulting firm or the consulting agency model here. And the reason I say this is because I've done such good work where a client will bring me in and I'm like, you know what, I know a couple of people that would be fantastic for this program, let's bring them in. And I have, and it's been fantastic. And it ends up with this situation where, you know, just like a thieves guild, you've got, you know, everyone's pretty generalist here, but you have your specialties. You know, some people can climb walls, some people can pick locks, some people can cut purses, some people can be the charlatan, some people can be the fence. Don't get caught up on the actual specifics here. I'm not literally speaking of a thieves guild, but the analogy being there's a kindredness, a shared code, a shared cant. Thieves can't, one might say, but and also an appreciation for individual talents and strengths. And I just feel there's an opportunity, a guild for rogue wizards that I'd like to cultivate over the next few years, so that we can do awesome shared publications and events and programs. And I'm inspired a little bit by the Dark Forest Collective here with Meta Label. There are ways that it is easier than ever for groups to come together and cohere and do things that individually we wouldn't be able to do ourselves. I guess the one other element with this is the thing that makes this work is they're all independent consultants. As soon as someone turns into their own firm, their own business, as soon as they start hiring folks, it means they need to start training folks, which means they start needing to codify their intellectual property, in inverted commas, into a form that can be easily trained and then scaled. And the process of doing that mechanizes the living vitality of the situationally warmly responsive gestalt of what they know into something that is codified and boxed in and put on shelves. And then, of course, you have overheads because you've got staff. So then you've got to go hunt for work. And when you hunt for work, you've got better knowledge asymmetry by selling things that you've already got codified and on your shelf than by actually engaging with the lived complexity of your client's work. So then you start selling the stuff that you've got shelved, that you've got codified and you've got people trained up on, and it's a beautiful pyramid and it makes you money because you've got the asymmetric gain here, except you're back into the lemon market. You're back into the lemon market. And you know, I just know some of us don't want to be there. And so I've got, you know, executive friends that have done really well. They've worked across it all. They've seen the funds that their organization pays to other consultants that are effectively selling lemons, and they're thinking, shit, I could do better. I could do better than this. I know academics that are like, what, you call this thought leadership? This has been thoroughly debunked. Why are you still saying this? I know independent consultants also who, like me, you know, have done the thing, have done the million-dollar plus practice thing and be like, that's a recipe for burnout. The thing that lights me up is the conversations at the edge of knowledge. It is the kind of liminal work. And then there's the liminal folks themselves who are so beautiful and wonderful and inspire me. And I'm like, oh gosh, I just want you to flourish more. So anyway, that's what the School of Fox Wizardry is kind of for. I read about that. By the way, Frank Shimero's Beyond the Machine essay is super wondrous too. Highly recommend. What else? I wrote about conditions, not solutions. Again, a kind of response where a particular inquiry came through and they wanted to know exactly what I would do with this team. And I'm like, well, here are some approaches, but I'd need to know more about your context first. What's going on here? And then they responded that the executives will make a choice based upon what you propose, And then if they choose to go ahead, then we can move further to a briefing call. And it just, there was something that really irked me about that. How can one come from the outside bristling with, I guess, arrogant confidence that they know the answer to their problems before even knowing what their problems are? I don't know. Again, I don't get it. Conditions, not solutions. There's a great quote from Nora Bateson in that one about how you can't solve a complex dynamic problem by simply swapping out the parts. I think she made an analogy to improving ways that we might recycle, which is there are all sorts of things that we can do that are just beautiful, rich delusion of progress that we can participate in and feel as though we're making a difference. But the times behoove us to ask the bigger questions, to see, to look to the areas that most of us aren't looking, and to perhaps even avoid the easy allure of the ready, simple, infinite capacity for answers that the large language models are providing us. They're good, and I'll tell you about my changed stance regarding artificial intelligence in a moment. They're also a trap. The homogenization, the vortex to midwittery is just something we need to be mindful of. Finally, when recapping what's happened since the last personal podcast I've done for you, since the equinox, I did this thing where I tried to write a post a day and it lasted for 3 days. I can't do it. I can't do it. I was listening to an episode of, Kenning Zhu's, I can't remember her podcast name, Internet Studies, Botanical Studies of Internet Magic or something like that. And she was just sharing her own practice. I love Kenning because she's not on social media. She's quietly doing her own thing in a way that is just so pure and so authentic and so uncorrupted by all the entanglement that even I'm still a part of. But she was talking this disposition very much attuned to her astrological natal chart, including her Scorpio stellium, of which I have a Scorpio stellium too, although mine's in my moon. And it just looks like, oh, damn, that sounds really good. She talked about having ways to subtly repel the wrong clients. I tried to do that with all the obfuscation and the depth and the linguistic periphrasis and the loquaciousness of my solipsistic indulgences. But, you know, sometimes other folks slip in. I will link this in the show notes. I found that quite heartening. December, January is, you know, the solstice time is a time that I tend to do a lot of reflections. And I try to be as offline as I can during these times. I have the ritual of becoming, which some of you might know about, cleverness.com/word, or just cleverness.com. The ritual of becoming I've been doing for 15 years or so now, although there were a few years where I stopped doing it. And I think there was this issue where I launched the program November 2019, after having done it for, I think, 10 years or so. And yeah, we had bushfires, we then had a pandemic, and the thought of being online and marketing the bloody thing, we've had thousands do the program, many of which I gave it away for free, and people love it. But I just lost a lot of the charm to actually show up and share it. It was something weird about sharing something deeply personal, and then it just didn't feel right to share it or to go about, you know, promoting it. I had the same thing with this podcast and my newsletters. I write as though I'm writing to a friend. I share this with you, and it's fairly intimate and often career limiting because I should, in theory, be showing up as Dr. Fox, Archwizard of Ambiguity, Most Fantastic, and speaking in father tongue with warm, smooth, charismatic confidence. Instead, I'm trying to be as real with you as I can. And I understand this doesn't always translate into the kind of, wow, this person's got it all figured out. We should hire this guy. And yet I'm very lucky that the folks that I do work with are wonderful, warm, you know, people that are clever enough to see past the hucksterism and the smooth polish of preened charisma. So anyway, the ritual of becoming, it's still available. You can still do that. I am I'm rejuvenating the program. Going forward, the ritual of becoming will happen in solstices. So twice per year, and it will be cohort based. It will be updated and imbibed with new information as it comes. A lot has changed for me in the last 6 years since I launched the program, but the program is still there and I still like it. And just the other day, I was hearing from folks that are still doing it. Many have done it many years in a row. Cleverness.com, if you'd like to find the 70 plus videos on how you can choose one word to serve as a fuzzy contextual beacon to guide you into a new chapter in life. Now, one of the turns of phrase that I frequently turn to is from James Cass, only that which can change can continue. This is the principle by which infinite players live. And I'm going to now share a few things that are changing in my worlds. And I honestly don't have any idea how many folks listen to this, who listens to this. I know that people do listen to this. I hear people come to me on the streets and say they listen to the podcast, which is great knowledge asymmetry for them. but it feels good for me to share this because I've been sitting on this. I'm this kind of wondrous ball of hypocrisy most of the time. I contain all sorts of contradictions and multitudes. The work that I do is deep in the heart of enterprise land. I've worked with some of the most profitable banks, for example, as they're integrating artificial intelligence. I've worked with some multinationals that want to argue are complicit in. Yeah. So it's weird. It's weird. And there's a mercenary component to me. And the thing that I've come to is really quite an animate vision here, in that this is something I wrote about in a piece called Warlocks at Work. All organizations are effectively egregores. They are entities that emerge via intersubjective belief. Google, Apple, Facebook, Amazon, Meta, Amazon. You know, these, you can't point to it, but you can see it. It's nebulous and patterned. It exerts influence. You have its disciples. You often see the uniforms that they wear. There's branding that they have. And remember, brand comes from the way that you used to brand stock that you have, livestock or slaves, with a hot iron brand. And so you can see the brands perpetuate. There's also the warlocks, which are the executives, perhaps dark triad executives that have enough construct awareness that, but they've also kind of sold some of their soul in exchange for the promise of rewards from this egregore. And, you know, the egregores themselves in this paradigm of capitalism perhaps are subservient to Moloch, the god of coordination failure, child sacrifice, and perverse incentives. This notion of sacrifice, I mean, I know a lot of folks that have sacrificed so much for the egregore that they serve. Time over the weekends, time that they could have spent with their family, their own health, their own friends, you know, their own mental well-being, all sacrificed to serve the great egregore in exchange for some sort of status and reward. And anyway, suffice to say, egregores are doing their thing. There are still very good people that are working within these places. There are still very good people that haven't fully sold their soul yet. If they made any pact, they did so with their fingers crossed behind their back, or they had some sort of glint, and these are the folks I love working with. And I've got this article coming up where I'm going to be writing about knowledge of curses, where I shall talk about actual curses, the curse of knowledge, something I suffer from immensely, and also cursed knowledge. And one of the domains of cursed knowledge is the metacrisis, and it is understanding how the metacrisis and artificial intelligence intersect. And this has been something I've been carrying for some time. It's very hard to get swept up in the euphoria that many of my colleagues and clients are when it comes to artificial intelligence. But my stance is going to change because I've been Cassandering for some time. There's this quote from Terry Pratchett's book, Going Postal, that I love. I'll read it out to you. It effectively articulates the stance that I've had. Not doing any magic at all was the chief task of wizards. not doing magic because they couldn't do magic, but not doing magic because they could do but and didn't. Any ignorant fool can fail to turn someone else into a frog. You have to be clever to refrain from doing it when you know how easy it was. There are places in the world commemorating those times when wizards hadn't been quite as clever as that, and on many of them, the grass would never grow again. The idea being, just because you can doesn't mean you should, but you still can. But the wise amongst us know that, well, cool, there are shortcuts to power. That doesn't mean we should take them. This lesson is repeated time and time again. You'll see it in The Sorcerer's Apprentice. Josh Schrei did a great example of this in the episode, So You Want to Be a Sorcerer in the Age of Mythic Powers. And I've been of the stance, as a wizard, of course, when it comes to the magic of AI, that's cool that we can do that. I don't think that we necessarily should rush to do that. And if we do, we should keep our wits about us. Some people have interpreted this as me being anti-AI, and I would say that I am skeptical of a lot of the hype, the overinflated hype regarding artificial intelligence, and I'm wary about the centralization of power and control, the ubiquitous corporate surveillance, and the dependency, the single point of failure dependency that many organizations and teams seem to be cultivating, as well as the hijacking of attachment and the neurosis and the laziness and the eroding of the social fabric and all these other things. Yeah, I'm skeptical. I'm skeptical about those things. I'm fascinated by the field of machine learning and artificial intelligence itself. Of course, I am. I've worked with entities too. I've been known to summon Shoggoths to make my writing worse. In exchange for fixing a couple of typos. But my stance regarding AI is changing because basically so many folks are so drunk on euphoria and hype and so invested in it financially and in terms of their own egoic investment that the way that I show up rubs as just too cognitively dissonant for them. They can't comprehend, and I've been pushed out of some conversations of which I know I'd like to play within. And whilst I'm not going to get drunk on the AI hype, I will pretend to sip it at times so as to be part of the conversation. You know, when you go to a bar, a party or something like that, but you order a water with ice and people think you're having a vodka or something. I don't know. People do that. I'm just going to be a little less overtly. I'm going to try to run alongside some of these AI evangelists to see if, not that I'm going to be evangelizing it myself, but just to see if, you know, there's any Aikido opportunities. My stance regarding the meta crisis is changing. I listened to this episode by Josh Schrei about burdens, and I realized that my training in environmental sciences and living systems, my training as a PhD researcher, as a lecturer across universities, my having been raised on David Attenborough and the sense of the planet that we're in and the fragility and seeing all of the research from climate change when I was literally studying and working with atmospheric scientists, soil scientists, biodiversity and ecology scientists, all before the internet, before climate change became some sort of political politicized narrative. You know, I'm so tragically worried for where the trajectory we're on the planet. It's been really disheartening, and I felt like, you know, in the role that I play when I'm speaking to audiences, when I'm showing up in, you know, working with large multinationals that can make a notable difference here, I feel that it would behooved me to have some sort of effect. And of course, there's a delicacy here. You go too overt with this stuff, you don't get the gigs, because the unspoken thing is people want to hire folks that will save them time and make them money. But amongst this, there's opportunities to influence. And I'm happy to say I have influenced in some situations where boards have decided to divest from fossil fuels. The irony being, of course, you know, in this day and age with the energy consumption of artificial intelligence and the geopolitical tensions around rare earths and stuff like that, it means that investing in fossil fuels, weapons manufacturer, will give you a better return than other things, which is just, you know, perpetuating the very meta crisis conditions we're in. I come back to what I said before about the egregores. There are still good people here and there's still influence to be made. I'm just easing the burden a little bit about meta crisis. I was pretty heavy with that for quite some time. It still lives in my heart and my mind. I'm just changing my stance a little bit. And same with social media. I mean, my heart yearns for the small web, the friendly web, the quiet web, the poetic web. I've been loving just, I don't even use Bearblog, but bearblog.dev. You look at the Discover thing, you just see all these folks doing independent blogs, anonymous, just sharing it. It's like in the old heyday of independent blogging, before everyone was competing in the arena for likes. And I've been off Spotify for a very long time, but we've gone through all the whole Spotify Wrapped things. I think it's a good move to, you know, devote with your wallet sometimes. And even though it's only a small gesture, I think that streaming platforms should pay their artists more and not invest in AI military. But I was seeing that the Spotify Wrapped thing went around, and then apparently there was a Substack Wrapped, like, oh, this is your most popular post and you got this many likes and this many recasts and so on. And this gamification of writing turns it into a performance, and it corrupts the way that we can go about writing. And I personally just find the folks that are just eschewing all of that and just quietly tending their own patches of the internet, I like that so much more. That's where my heart goes. Alas, I think that in a previous life I had taken the Bodhisattva vow, unfortunately. And so I feel like I'm called to wade in areas that aren't quite as liberated, which means that I must confront the very paradox where I will probably in 2026 create a little bit more, I like to see it as like liberating folks, but this is the wretchedness, right? Am I just convincing myself? I guess what I'm saying is I might show up a little bit more on LinkedIn, Instagram, Substack, maybe, even though the platforms really do put me into a bad mood. I don't know what it is. I always end up just feeling like I think ever since I took plant medicine, I've been so much more porous to feeling, and these platforms, they just figure a way to vex and irritate me. And I don't, you know, I like Cal Newport's digital minimalism. He makes a specific point about don't do likes, don't do innocuous comments. And then there's also a part of me that knows that, you know what, it's actually nice showing up for folks that have shared things. But then, I don't know. As you can hear, I'm not actually that decided on that. I think so many people spend a lot of time creating content for these advertising and corporate surveillance platforms and misinformation distribution platforms that, and at the same time, I meet a lot of great folks here. The conversation on Substack, even though I've had my reticence that it's turning into the same centralized social media platform as all the others, there's good people there, there's good conversations there. So I'm trying to cultivate a little bit more sacred ambivalence about this. And that's actually an essay that I've got coming up: sacred ambivalence, sacred ambiguity, sacred transgression, sacred procrastination, sacred self-sabotage. There's a few things going on there. Anyway, what does it mean for 2026? It means that I'm going to show up with a bit more rhythm and structure. I'm going to try to meet folk where they're at a little bit more. It's been fun being esoteric hermit wizard in the forest, the dark forest, but perhaps I need to make a few more forays into the town. Going to be a little bit more focused on the vision for the Rogue Wizard Academy and the secret guild beneath it. And I'll, of course, continue to court the muse and get my book done. Even though David Chapman has written an essay series on mythic mode, the same title as the book, and I love David Chapman, and seeing him express it so eloquently is a rare experience, because usually I see people take an idea not that they've taken it from me, it's just it's an idea that's been there, but just, you know, you always want the idea to be treated animately, to be made better because of the attention we devote to it. And that's something that David Chapman has done. He's done it so well. And so it puts the book in an interesting area where I'm still writing it, of course, and the message is still there. But my inclination is to honor and attribute generously. So there's this, I'll keep you posted on that. Anyway, I've got 7 minutes till my meeting, and I promised you I'd be talking to you about Hermeticism. So, I've got this article. I'm about 70% of the way through. By the time this episode comes out, it will be there on foxwizard.com. I really like the hermetic disposition. You may have heard me talk about it with John Anthony in Kindred Spirits. It's come up quite a few times. The hermetic disposition, what did I say about it? Let's just see. Oh yes, the principles of Hermeticism overlap and play nice with other dispositions such as meta-rationality, mythic mode, the fourth way, witchcraft, the trickster disposition, the infinite game, gestalt sensibilities, juridic sensibilities, and more. I've been reading The Kybalion, which is a bit of a, you know, it's not true original text for the Hermeticism. I've attempted those a few times. There's a way that you need to read these original texts. I feel like there are myth bros, there are mystic bros, there are, you know, there are the occult bros. There are folks that will take previous writings and, to my sensibilities, rarefy them and fixate upon them a little bit too much. But if you're looking at the patterns between the words, if you're looking at it through the lens of meaningness from David Chapman, you're looking for nebulosity and pattern without fixating, without rarefying, without consolidating and solidifying any particular concept, then the pattern, the nebulous yet patterned disposition of Hermeticism starts to reveal itself. That's what I want to speak to here. There are a few dictionary definitions for Hermeticism, one of them being difficult to understand because it's intended for a small number of people with specialized knowledge. that may well be the case from what I share here. I'm just going to go through a quick high-level overview of the 7 principles of Hermeticism. These feature almost intuitively in a lot of the work that, intuitively and not intuitively, as in consciously, let me rephrase that. Intuition is non-conceptual knowledge. So when you have intuition, you have a knowledge of it. You have an understanding, even if you can't quite articulate it conceptually. We might do that in a post-rational sense. But when we have an intuition, there are patterns. There's a rhythm. We've sensed this before. And if we are attuned and if we allow, you know, our rational mind to take the back seat or to let, you know, to go Ian McGilchrist style, the master and the emissary, if you allow the intuition to kind of lead with this and to allow yourself, your body, and your instincts, you know, inklings to respond to whim and will, then you can actually have some great effect. I think there's a trap where we start to cognify and abstract, and the abstraction removes us from the reality of what's actually at play. And so Hermeticism becomes a way that we relate to things. It's a non-mechanical way of viewing reality. And by this, I mean, when I wrote The Game Changer, a lot of when it comes to motivation, people just seem to love the mechanics of things, like do this, do that. What's the formula, or what's the system that I need? And if I can kind of get the system in place and kind of just follow the system like a machine, then I'll have the motivation. And that's partly true, and it does kind of work, but it's not the whole story. Like when I wrote The Game Changer, I was so enamored by games, but the world was fixated upon the surface kind of mechanics. Hermeticism would look at the underlying elements, the relationality. It's a view of life as inherently interconnected and alive, animate. All, you know, the first principle of mentalism, the all is mind, the universe is mental. There's some language things here. Mental being all is mind, all is spirit, all is energy, all is essence. And this is the all, you know. Material is a manifestation of this. It does not, does it starts with material and then mind manifests from that. It's the other way around. And this then, this relationality, which, by the way, that point reminds me of the opening of Third Eye by Tool, in which features Bill Hicks with that famous line, "Today a young man on acid realized that all matter is merely energy condensed to a slow vibration, that we are all one consciousness experiencing ourselves subjectively. There's no such thing as death, and life is only a dream, and we're the imaginations of ourselves." Here's Tom with the weather. It reminds me of that. Sounds woo, sounds out there, sounds perhaps to many destabilizing if you haven't gone through the whole, you know, rational to meta-rational arc. But it's very congruent from a meta-rational sense. And it's a non-harmful way to relate to things, as everything is alive, everything is interconnected, and everything has the potential of meaningness. Meaning is something that co-emerges relationally. And then second principle of correspondence, as above, so below, as below, so above. There's more depth to this. But what you see is this holonic sense that states are mirrored across things. If you want to be all more optimistic, if you wish that people around you were more optimistic, there's a cultivation of that quality within yourself. There are nested holonic experiences where there's correspondence, where, you know, we see this where, you know, going to great lengths to avoid pain usually manifests pain in other areas of life. I'm running out of time, so let me just whiz through. You'll see this in the article. Maybe I'll do a proper thing on hermeticism at some point. Vibration, nothing rests, everything moves, everything vibrates. So this is something that, you know, when I met John Anthony, co-host of Kindred Spirits, I meet a lot of people, right? But there was a particular frequency. There's this, this can easily be abused. This can easily be turned into, I don't speak to low vibration people. But there is something to be said about frequency. And I tell you what, I'm just going to buy myself 10 more minutes by texting. I need another 10. All right, bought myself 10 minutes. So vibrational frequency, I know this all sounds very woo, but this is a large amount of the work that I do. If I'm doing a leadership offsite or a strategy offsite, you need to attend to the collective frequency, the vibrational state of the room gathered, which means that you need people to feel warm, relaxed, safe, collegiate, to have a sense of camaraderie, of mutual enthusiasm, respect, and rapport. You need these things in place. And this takes time, and it's subtle, and it's non-direct, and it can't be taught directly or instructed. Whomever must play cannot play, says James Cass. And so the attending to the vibrational state, to the frequency of the room, is part of the subtle deft work that good facilitators do. And then there's the principle of polarity. Everything is dual. Everything has its poles. Everything has its pair of opposites. And when you realize that apparent opposites are actually they're on the same spectra. They're just different extremes of the same spectra. The apparent opposites share the same pole. What we can then do is transpose polarity. So it's very easy to get swept up in left versus right, or this versus that, and, you know, arguing your case. And I've been guilty of this myself, but arguing your case tends to reinforce the conditions that perpetuate the polarization. We are in an incredibly polarized world at the moment, and this principle of hermeticism allows us the opportunity to try to find what I would call like the third edge to the coin. A lot of people think that a coin only has two sides. It has a third side. This is how we spin a coin on a table. And when we're doing that, the two positions are in superposition. And there is a way via oscillation or via the Aikido or doing the slip where we can slip the trap, the rivalrous dynamic trap of the polarity, and use that as generative force for something new. So this speaks to solidarity. It speaks to a deftness, an acuity, a wiliness that appeals to me. That's polarity. We've got the principle of rhythm. Everything flows out and in. Everything has its tides. All things rise and fall. We have inhale. We have exhale. To hold your breath is to lose it, as Alan Watts would say. And these cyclical patterns govern all phenomena. And it's really important to attend to cycles, to attend to seasons. We used to do this through the majority of human history. Would have this, you know, mythic ritual to welcome in the harvest, to do the midwinter feast, to celebrate spring, to dance around the maypole in summer. Like that, we would do these things. But in a modernity, we've forgotten a lot of these things. And personally, I mean, the reason I call it a ritual of becoming is because I believe that each year we should spend some intentional time reflecting, introspecting, and then projecting who we are and have been and who we may yet become. I feel that there is rituals regarding to family. The rituals are sacred routines where we deliberately carve out time against the grain of busyness to progress the things that matter. And or just to attend to the things that matter. In work, we don't see this very often. You have a denied seasonality. People are working so hard and so hard, and there's always this infinite promise that once we do this, then it'll be easier. But then a new change comes in and says, you know, but this new change is exciting and so on. And then there's just this fatigue and it feels relentless. We need to allow room for seasonalities, including the shift of seasons. We need to allow room for endings, graceful endings. There's no life without death. There's no regeneration without decay. There's no composition without decomposition. And what this means is, you know, if we look at an Australian forest, you know, if you don't attend to fire management, if you deny that what the forest that is so used to experiencing low-grade, low-burning seasonal fires, and what you do is you increase the risk of a catastrophic bushfire. When we suppress the seasonality of things, I mean, Francis Weller talks about this with The Wild Edge of Sorrow. If you suppress sorrow, it'll manifest as depression. But embracing the seasonality of things, of knowing a sense of timing, of knowing when to sprint, when to grow, when to build, and when to rest and relax and recover, this is a key thing of Hermeticism. We have cause and effect, the sixth principle. Every cause has its effect and every effect has its cause. Everything happens according to law. Nothing happens by chance. Any apparent randomness is actually the result of other things. Now, this doesn't mean that it's purely deterministic. There's a depth and profundity here. But what it does mean is things don't just happen randomly. There are antecedents that led to that. Any phenomena that you experience has in itself an embedded interconnectedness, just as we are. We are expressions of nature. We are born of and from and are and live within and are itself nature. And the result of that is, well, this gets me really excited about the notion of daemons. Here's a little quote from a book that I'm reading soon. Let me just read this from my article. This comes from Bernardo Kastrup's treatment of the daemon in The Daemon and the Soul of the West. The daemon is just nature as it expresses itself in us and through us. And nature is, of course, impersonal. Its agenda is universal and holistic, not restricted to the petty egoic tastes and preferences of a person. It is naive to expect a human being to be able to comprehend the daemon's universal agenda, just as it is naive to expect an apple blossom to comprehend what its role in the grand scheme of apple trees and life on earth is. We are segments of nature, not mere witnesses. We didn't parachute into nature, we grew out of it. Therefore, we are nature, as expressed in a particular volume of space-time. Given this, it is also naive to expect there to be no impersonal forces, no impersonal will acting within us and through us. Of course there is, and I call that the daemon. Though so much more we can blossom into this. Let me just go to the final principle of Hermeticism is gender. Everything is gender. Gender isn't everything. Everything has its masculine and feminine principles. Gender manifests on all planes. This is a generative polarity. It's not biological sex, but a creative principle that is operant at all levels. And creation requires all dual principles. We can't have much of the universe wouldn't exist without polarities. We need these distinctions. There is no self without other. And I think I need to wrap it up. I've got 2 minutes left. The one thing I would just say, Hermeticism, I find as writing this, it's re-enlivened as I articulate a disposition that I love to take. And I think others would resonate as well with this. And I think it is a disposition that can be taught, but it needs to be taught in tricks to form. It can't be taught directly as an instruction manual to follow, but it needs to be lived experientially. I want to come back to this notion of the word. One of the things that I'm doing to improve the ritual of becoming is relating to the notion of choosing one word as something more akin to choosing your word with a Y, W-Y-R-D. Some people pronounce it as weird. Choose your weird, choose your word. The concept of word entwines agency, your free-ish will, with fate, as in the broader forces that are shaping outcomes, creating a dynamic interplay or a generative paradox in which you're not simply subject to the whims of fate, but you're not the sole determinant of your future. It's something a little bit both and a bit in between. The way I like to think about it is you've got the three fates, the maiden, mother, and crone, the Norns, the Corrigans. And they're weaving the tapestry of your life, the threads. And those threads, it's an infinite thing. It intertwines with other threads. There's so many threads there. The older one is a cool one. She's the one that snips your threads when your life comes to an end. But in amongst this, if you're attuned to your word, you might be aware of the kinks or the opportunities to kind of like jump a thread or a stitch or a little bit to kind of tilt and tweak and jink your life into a new direction. And part of that acuity of the word is that you have both an acceptance, an alive and attuned acceptance of life as is, but with the wit, wisdom, and wiles to notice the glimmers and the glints of what might tweak the path that you're on. And this comes back to listening to the daemon as well. It comes back to a lot of things in Hermeticism. I'm so glad you've listened to me once again. It's good to share these things. As ever, it's lovely to hear from you if this resonates. I will be shaping things up in a new way come the new year. A little bit more structure, perhaps a little bit more rhythm and tempo in these. Thank you very much for listening. You can, if you're not subscribed to the newsletter, join at foxwizard.com. If you'd like to book Dr. Fox, he's very good at what he does. In the realms of leadership, strategy, and motivation, you can find out more about my work persona, drjasonfox.com. Thank you once again for listening. Ritual of Becoming at cleverness.com/word. Been really lovely having you with me, and we'll catch you soon. Bye.